So the book is called Readings from the Book of Exile. When I was studying my undergrad, it always did strike me that while exile is such an enormous theme and factual part of the Hebrew history, there isn't a book called the Book of Exile, although there are certainly prophets that could be seen as prophets of exile or post-exile and pre-exile. Partly, I suppose, it's appropriate that exile is unnamed in terms of the geography of the Hebrew Bible, in terms of a particular book. So that it was that that struck me, to think, if you were to give a book of exile words, what would you do? So there's seven chapters called Reading from the Book of Exile, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, then chapter 5, then the unnameable chapter, and then chapter 6. The unnameable chapter is particularly poems of grief. I suppose, as a poet, I suppose poets are supposed to be known for putting words on things, but to my mind, the limitations of words is deeply important, and I have to be deeply in contact with the fact that poems are only able to say a certain amount, but that blank space can say an enormous amount as well, which is why I like the poetic form, because there is so much blank space on the page, so much on the page that can't be said, the bits that are simply left out. So I'll read a selection from a few of them, probably not a selection from all seven sections, that might pour the life out of you, but the first one I'll look at is called Narrative Theology, number 1. And I said to him, "Are there answers to all of this?" And he said, "The answer is in a story, and the story is being told." And I said, "But there is so much pain." And she answered plainly, "Pain will happen." Then I said, "Will I ever find meaning?" And they said, "You will find meaning where you give meaning. The answer is in a story, and the story isn't finished." So for me, I suppose the beginning of telling the story of exile always has to be rooted in what are the way that things are. Exile is when something has been taken out of your control and you are in a place where you do not want to be, but where you simply are. And that in itself can be a very difficult first step, to name where you are, because often we name where we're not. And I think one of the earliest parts about the truth of exile is learning to tell the truth of things as they are, to sit with your resentment, but also to find a sense of control in the lack of control which has resulted in your exile. There's a very short poem that speaks to that, called The Beginning of Wisdom. The beginning of wisdom was when I learnt the difference between believing in the truth and telling the truth about belief. Exile took on a particular connotation for me too after hearing a Midrashic scholar, Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg, who's based in Jerusalem, speak about the Genesis narrative, in particularly Genesis 1 and 2, talking about the Garden of Eden. And she was being interviewed by Krista Tippett, and she was explaining that the exit from the Garden of Eden, while it can be considered an exile, isn't necessarily thought of in the Jewish imagination as a fall in the way that it would have been. I mean, for a lot of people to talk about the fall, people just go, "Oh yeah, Genesis 3 immediately. It's almost taken as such an authoritative title for the events that it might even be considered to be inherent within the text. And she was saying that in the Jewish imagination, it's a little bit more of an expansion than a fall. And the first thing that Adam does upon leaving the garden is to name his wife Eve, because she was the mother of all that is living. And so the first thing he does is to name the source of life, which demonstrates in a certain sense that even in Adam's imagination, as he's written in the text, that this wasn't necessarily the beginning of death, but rather the beginning of something new, a growing up. And perhaps they were always supposed to grow up, because the way they're spoken of is these adults who never had childhoods. And there's a certain innocence in the way that they're portrayed, an innocence that might lend itself to fantasy, but perhaps not lend itself to speaking about what it means to be human. When we read the beginning of their blaming of each other and the beginning of their journeying somewhere where they don't know and where life is going to be difficult, then we go, now I recognize what it means to be human. So there's a poem here called Joriacht, which is the Irish word for exile. And Joriacht carries with it the implication in Irish to be in a state of tears. And it's a beautiful poetic word. So here's a poem thinking about Adam and Eve. And their God was carved from their own hollow breathing. Their toil was hard, their babies born grieving. Clothed with desire, they continued believing that their lives began with their Edenic leaving. And he's afraid, and he will fear, and he is hiding, and he is here. Their path was worn as the furnace was yawning. They slept in the evening, they spoke in the dawning. She was the mother of all that was breathing. He was the earth, and she was his reason. And she's afraid, and she will fear, and she is hiding, and she is here. They came from nothing, so the nothing came with them. Their chaos lay open, and their chaos played with them. And they're afraid, and they will fear, and they are hiding, and they are here. They move between cunning and exposure, sometimes one answer, sometimes many, sometimes silence, never closer. And we're afraid, and we fear, and we are hiding, and we are here. There is a second poem called Narrative Theology, which my finishing a master's at the moment, which is looking at the application of literary criticism to the gospel texts. Looking at structure, looking at story, looking at characterization, looking at points of view, looking at all the kinds of things that you look at in literary structure, and then applying them to the gospel texts and looking at a format which is appropriate for the genre of the gospels. Narratology, I suppose, or narrative theology would be what's come up as. And there's a poem here which is trying to think about the idea of God within that. Like, does our life have a structure, a beginning and an end? For some people it's very important to say that it does. For other people, their lives have been so visited by chaos or grief that to imply that there is a storyteller behind all that is insulting. So this poem is trying to strike a balance within that. Oh no, not strike a balance. That's not true at all. I'm not sure what it's trying to do. It's trying to put words to that and not try to solve it deliberately by putting things that are often seen to be contrasting side by side. Narrative Theology number 2. I used to need to know the end of every story, but these days I only need the start to get me going. God is the crack where the story begins. We are the crack where the story gets interesting. We are the choice of where to begin, the person going out or the stranger coming in. God is the fracture and the ache in your voice. God is the story flavored with choice. God is the pillar of salt full of pity, accusing God for the sulphurous city. God is the woman who bleeds and who touches. We are the story of courage or blushes. God is the story of whatever works. God is the twist at the end and the quirks. We are the start and we are the center. We're the characters, narrators, inventors. God is the bit that we can't explain. Maybe the healing, maybe the pain. We are the bit that God can't explain. Maybe the harmony, maybe the strain. God is the plot and we are the writers. The story of winners, the story of fighters. The story of love and the story of rupture. The story of stories and the story without structure.
Well, I want to just interrupt you just very quickly, because there are paintings, as people, some of your friends and colleagues have written, or painted paintings based on some of the verses in your
That's
poems.
Right, yes,
and
yeah.
I certainly remember seeing the one of God as a crack where the story begins, which I think is just an incredible phrase to use, and it was a very vivid painting as well that was done, or artwork that was done for that.
Yes, for the launch I had given the text of the book to some friends who were artists, painters, sculptors, or mixed media artists, photographers, and they each responded in their own way to some of them. And some of them had pieces that already were exploring those themes. And so for the launch, which we had in a cafe in the south part of Belfast, we had put up an exhibition, and each of the artists' work was for sale, and then had some wine and a poetry reading, as well as some stories from a night called 10 by 9 that myself and my partner run, which is a storytelling night that brings 9 people together well, it showcases 9 stories from people's lives. It gives 9 people up to 10 minutes each to tell a real story from their life. So the idea was that it was a night of art, poetry, real stories, and then painting and sculpture and photography and mixed media as well. So, thinking about stories, and the particular that poem, that God is the crack where the story begins, there... For me, there is an interesting way in which our stories overlap each other. Sometimes one person might be going through devastation and another person is going through such magnificent consolation that it seems like there's something unkind or cruel in bringing those together, or perhaps truly kind and truly consoling in bringing stories together, that while one person is in grief, another person is in joy. So there's a poem called Circle, which is written for a lovely friend of mine, Danny. I had written a poem years ago about life, and it was a poem about prayer, really, and loving prayer and moving deeply into prayer. It was curiously written because I wasn't feeling like that. My life was falling apart at the time, and somehow I wrote this poem about life, and it was a shock to me that I was able to produce something that I found consoling. And then I must have sent it to Danny, and she was going through some trauma of her own at the time, some real life-changing trauma. And she was saying that she used to sit on the back step of her house smoking cigarettes, repeating lines to herself. And so she told me that years later. And I think within around 2 minutes, this poem was written as a testament to the curious ways in which lives and joy and sadness circle each other, not cancelling each other out, but just coexisting at the same time. It was called Circle. It's funny how things come in circles. You sitting on a step, smoking a cigarette, watching leaves fall off a slowly stripping tree. Me hanging photos on a wall, including one of you receiving, like a priestess, your lover's confession. Me telling stories of your conversations. You weeping when your dad asked you how you were. Me writing poems about life while I was slowly plunging into death. You breathing in those same lines, sitting on a step, smoking a cigarette.
I'm sure Danny gets to hear that one as well.
Yes.
Was she touched to know that you had written a poem about
her?
Yeah,
I sent it to her and she wrote back saying something like, "Oh, you sweetie," or something like that. Danny's so full of life. She said something very affectionate. Like, I don't remember exactly what she said, but there was something very moving about that. I think in times of exile, we turn to stories that we know, and stories that we know, sacred stories especially, have a power to begin a process of helping us to find a narrative, to find a centrality for ourselves, which is very important, you know, very meaningful. I suppose sacred stories can be texts of terror if they're told poorly, but they can be texts of consolation if they're told well. And if we can find ourselves within them, and if we can find the space within a story for our own ambiguities, our own contradictions. And I think the last chapter of the book of the Gospel of John, which is the chapter where Peter says at the start, "I'm going fishing," and 6 of the disciples follow him, and then he is out fishing and somebody points to a character cooking fish and bread on the seashore and says, "It's the Lord." And curiously, he's stripped, but he puts on his clothes before jumping into the water, which is a very strange thing to do, but the text does record that. There's an element of, I mean, there is a Hebrew anxiety regarding nudity that might be coming forward. The word for nude in naked or uncovered in Hebrew, gala, is the same as the word for exile in Hebrew, which is a very interesting thing, that somehow exile is an uncovering, a violent uncovering perhaps, of something that you would wish not to be exposed. So perhaps that's the reason why the writer of the Gospel of John wrote that in the sense that he was at least trying to cover a part of himself, even though he was going to meet the guy who he had only previously denied 3 times. So let me see if I can find where it is. Oh, you've got the page
got
open.
Here. It's page 30. And you have to give the full title because a lot of poems
Okay. Tend
to be quite short. But this one, it actually just says exactly what the poem is.
Actually, the title of this poem is inspired by the magnificent American poet, Billy Collins, who in one of his collections has written a book called he's written a poem called Reading an Anthology of Chinese Poetry, I Pause to Admire the Length and Clarity of Their Titles. So I just thought that was so exquisite in its composition as a title that I thought I'd give a little shout out to it. This title approaches nothing of the elegance of Billy Collins, but this one is called Of Skinny Dipping, Lonely Nights, Charcoal Fires, Absolution, Loads of Guilt, Breakfast, Bucketfuls of Projection and Forgiveness, a longish reflection on the last chapter of the fourth gospel. So, and I do exercise poetic license in that, in the way that I tell it here. Peter doesn't clothe himself, he dives naked into cold water. Dove naked into cold water near the cove where the clothed man cooked fish. The water was teeming with 153 screaming out, I do not know the man, I do not know the man, I do not know the man whose shackled hands I'd held the last time I'd seen the sea walking towards me on Sophia's heels, stepping over chaos and creating madman's dreams. 153, and he a carpenter telling me, the fisher, cast your nets in the light of day. So I explained that while I am a ragged man, my sins are rich and meaty, I would take a beating before I heard a carpenter lay down the rules of eating from the sea. 153, and me I followed because I knew no other way. This was the way of glory, the only way before me. My wife, she understood, or at least she kept her peace. 73 leaping from the sea to nets so empty they seemed dry. Now I am leaping naked from the deck to sea, and me, I'm hoping for a bit of absolution while I perform my oceanic ablutions. I am naked, ploughing depths of wombing waters, salty with my tears and years of endless trying. 3 times of saying, no, I do not know him, no, I do not know him, no, I do not know him, so can I show him anything that is different now? He said, hello. The carpenter, he said, hello, and I said, yeah, I know, pulling clothes around my body, covering my hair and skin from showing. 3 times with bread and fish around a charcoal fire, and I was questioned of my love. Do I love him more than fish, more than all this, more than miracles and me and all that's in me? Jesus, you know everything, I said, and then I wept. You know damn well everything. I drank from miraculous new waters, and then I faltered while the devil sauntered downtown. I am the pebble in your crown, Jerusalem's new clown. I've let you down, I've let you down, I've let you down. I've left me damn well down. Jesus, you know everything, I said, and then I wept. Are we beyond all this? Can we move on, he said. The miracles, big ball bravado, ah, your sad old ego vying for acceptance. Are we beyond all this? Can we move on, he said. Jesus, you know everything and the weight inside my head, I said. And he said, come now, fisherman, come on, and maybe sing a different tune, and find a room where you can let me stay, and maybe take that oar out from your own eye, and paddle back to where I started with you. Let's be beyond all this, and let's move on, he said to me. For me, that chapter has been a very significant chapter. Every year on my birthday, I read it. And I came to that chapter, I mean, I knew it, I'd heard it, but I came to that chapter in the end of John's Gospel at one point years ago when I was trying to make a decision about what to do. And I mean, in the end, the decision that I made as a result of that chapter on that day didn't eventuate, but it was so much more than finding an answer. It was finding a way of being, finding a place within a story, and finding a grounding within the way that things are now, that helped, and that chapter signifies to me finding a grounding, not a kind of a soothsayer telling of the future or prediction of how will things be. Rather, it's settling into and a finding of a space of human encounter that I find very meaningful, especially that John writes that it was a charcoal fire around which Peter had denied him, and it's a charcoal fire that Jesus has burning on the ocean, on the sea shore. So it's very elegantly written by the writer of the Gospel of John. but there's something much more than literary elegance within it. There's a deep human knowing that something needed to be restored in Peter, and that he had to come face to face with himself, and that the Jesus of that text isn't shocked by John, or isn't shocked by Peter. He's much more comfortable around that charcoal fire than Peter is, I think. Peter is the one who needs to be brought into his own comfort. So this poem, I think, is trying to examine that. I finish with another poem. I suppose continuing on an idea of finding a certain sense of consolation and grounding when things are unstable. There's a line in Irish, if you're to say "I trust you," it's Muineen, who, very straightforward way of saying "I trust you." But in on the Dingle Peninsula in County Kerry, there the dialect of Irish spoken there is a beautiful dialect of Irish. And a friend of mine, Maria Garvey, whose family are from that way, was telling me that in a particular part of the Dingle Peninsula, rather than saying Muineen, who in real times of importance they say the following phrase, Mahyasavert Lawn Khoshatinna, which means "you are the place of my standing on the day when my feet are sore," which is so visual and so literal. You are the place of my standing on the day when my feet are sore, as a way of implying trust. It's a beautiful phrase. Maria, who's the leader of the Larsh community here in Belfast, said that to me once over a cup of coffee, and I was heading to a party. I was getting the train out to Hollywood, and all I had was a pencil and a kind of crumpled up envelope, and this poem was on the back of that envelope by the time I got to the party. So where is it now? Page 44. There are some things that can't be stated quickly. Only history can meet us on the day when our grief greets us. It is only when I've sailed across an ocean meeting you that I can meet you truly, and I see you in me, and the me in you sees through me. You are the place of standing on days when feet are sore. You are the harbour's landing on the day of the waves' roar. You are the arms enfolding when I reject my flesh. You are my gentle breathing when I have lost my breath. And sometimes, though I have only met you, I know we've met before. In a meeting of the eyes, there is the greeting of a wise kind of knowing, and it shows us that a family is grown on the same such moments. The cleaving, the leaving, the making of some meaning in some exile, the naming of that nameless thing, the kind of sight that brings believing. And so, though the fright time hinders and the night time lingers longingly for us to grow inside her, we will find her handsome, rewarding, rich and full and lovely, wonderful and far above the other opportunities for being human. And we will find her tough, and we will roughly jostle with this mother, desperately wishing for another way for birthing out our living. But she is giving us our own selves, and we might live to tell the tale. And we will find our family on the day when the gale takes us into harbour, into shelter, into holding, into home.
Patrick, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
A real sense of peace and calm just sitting here in the middle of a working day.
Glad to bring that to a miserable afternoon in Belfast.
I wish you every success with the book.
Thanks very much.
Any further plans to maybe bring out another collection?
Yes, there are a few plans afoot, actually. The support and the enthusiasm from Canterbury Press has been everything from lovely to mildly overwhelming. So, which, that's a nice complaint. It's not even a complaint, but there are plans. A lot of the poetry that I've written on a professional capacity has been engaging with people whose lives have been affected by Irish history, you know, conflict, a history of conflict here. So I've a whole body of poems that are other people's stories. I suppose there's a lot of me in them too, because I'm writing about myself through the lens of other people. And then poems from people from other places of conflict as well. So the plan is to bring out a second collection that would be approaching some of those topics, looking, I suppose in some ways it's demonstrating a praxis of poetry as reframing and poetry as telling a story of conflict, Not from the point of view of bringing any resolution or answers, but simply from the point of view of telling it. So it's both poetry and a demonstration of praxis of community art as well.
And the story, you do story events, not too far away from where we are at the minute. On a regular basis?
Every month. Yeah, so 10 by 9. 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a real story from their life. And we choose a theme. So we've only started it a year ago, and we had themes of love, and love story was our first, and we had a theme called Sorry and a theme called Habits, and we had a theme called Paradise Lost and Paradise Found at Greenbelt this year, a theme of friendship. We had a theme on courage, and it's real stories, it's not fiction. It isn't a performative thing, even though people are performing. The night is for the lonely, for the normal, for the ordinary, for the nervous. Some people obviously come and they're much more used to speaking in public than others, but it's a lovely, warm atmosphere. There's no agenda, there's no facilitated dialogue sessions afterwards, you know. It's held in a kind of a cafe bar around the corner. And we've usually had around 40, 45 people listening, and then we've 9 people with up to 10 minutes each to tell their own story. 10by9.org is our website. 10 all spelled, 10 by 9 all spelled out. And we're on Twitter as well, 10x9, T-E-N-X, and then the number 9. So it's the best way to keep up with us there.
No excuses for not being able to
find definitely more not. Information. And just in case all that's too much, I've got a website of my own where that's got links to all those things called intheshelter.com, intheshelter.com.
Patrick, thank you very much for getting up your time.
My pleasure.
And wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you very much.